From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger, a Democrat from the state of Virginia, and we're coming to you from her office on Capitol Hill. Congresswoman Spanberger represents Virginia's 7th Congressional District. She's serving her first term in the House of Representatives after defeating the Republican incumbent in the November 2018 midterm elections. Congresswoman Spanberger is a member of the House Committee on Foreign Affairs and the House Committee on Agriculture. She also serves on the subcommittees on Europe, Eurasia, Energy and the Environment, as well as Asia, the Pacific, and nonproliferation. Before her election, Congresswoman Spanberger worked as a case officer in the CIA, where she collected vital intelligence in furtherance of U.S. national security priorities. In the private sector, she worked with colleges and universities to help them diversify their student bodies and increase graduation rates. On this edition of the program, we'll talk with Congresswoman Spanberger about a range of domestic and international issues facing the United States. We'll ask her about her legislative priorities, her views on President Trump's declaration of a national emergency at the southern border, negotiations with North Korea, among other pressing concerns. We'll also get her impression so far as a freshman member of Congress, one of a record 127 women serving in the U.S. Congress. Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Congratulations again on your victory. And as we commemorate Women's History Month, we salute you and all women, Republican and Democratic, who won seats in Congress in last November's elections.
Thank you so much. There's so many of us.
Yes, that's extraordinary. Let's talk about what prompted you to run for office. The seat you won was previously held by a Republican for about 38 years. You're one of many Democrats that captured seats that flipped the House of Representatives from a Republican-controlled chamber to now a democratically controlled one. To what extent do you think that sort of enhances your already gratifying victory, and what are the issues most important to you and your constituents?
Well, our race was an interesting one. As you mentioned, I flipped a seat that had long been Republican held. I did so by talking about the issues that were most important to voters. Healthcare was chief among them across our 10 counties. And I think that our victory signaled that voters are interested in something different. They want to see a change in the tenor and tone of politics. You know, I talked a lot about the issues that impact people's everyday lives and not so much about the hyper-partisanship that we see coming out of Washington these days. And so I think for so many of us who won in historically Republican-held districts, it was because we were talking about what was on people's mind, healthcare, education, infrastructure issues, and kept talking about those consistently. And now that we've arrived in Washington, those are the issues we're trying to address in our day-to-day work here legislating.
And in addition, you have a tremendous background in international affairs. You previously worked for the CIA, which means, of course, you have a keen sense of foreign affairs and national security. How does your work for that agency inform your role as a congresswoman?
So my work as a case officer with CIA informs my job here in a couple ways. One, it gives me a very broad perspective of what is happening in the realm of international affairs and national security, a lot of firsthand knowledge, because I worked so many of the topical issues that we're discussing still today. But the other piece is, as a case officer, as an intelligence officer, I was working every day to collect information on various different topics that were of great importance to policymakers and diplomats. And so you had to become a quick expert on issues because I was out in the field debriefing people talking about these issues. And so I have a lot of practice in asking a lot of questions, really seeking to understand, because it used to be me who was informing policymakers and diplomats, and now I'm the one who's endeavoring to be well-informed so I can make good policy.
I'd like to touch on a topic which is at the intersection of foreign and domestic policy. That's immigration. The Trump administration is interested in restricting not just illegal immigration, but even legal immigration. And because Mr. Trump was unable to get the money for the border wall he wants to continue to build at the southern border between the U.S. and Mexico, as you know, he declared a national emergency. And even in the 2020 budget, he's still asking for more funding. Do you think there's a national emergency at the southern border?
I think any national emergency that exists is a failure to discuss a real need for comprehensive immigration reform. What we've seen at the southern borders, we've seen people who are escaping violence in their home countries and looking for refuge. That is not a substantial change from what we've seen in decades past. And what we as Americans, as lawmakers, need to do is recognize that there is an issue that we need to address. And that issue is there are jobs that need high-skill and low-skill specialized workers to help our economy. And there is a tremendous opportunity to engage and create a comprehensive change in the way that we're handling immigration. And I think that oversimplifying the immigration discussion, as the president has, doesn't help us actually solve an issue, doesn't help employers throughout Central Virginia, in my case, or across the country. It doesn't help people who seek to come to this country and add to our richness and fullness and add to our economy.
And of course, many Republicans are also opposed to the declaration of the national emergency, even in the Senate. So I guess we'll see how that plays out. But meantime, how do you envision immigration reform? How would your proposal, for example, differ from the policies of the Trump administration?
I think it comes down to looking at what it is that we're trying to address. Our district is a great example. We have rural and agricultural communities that depend on labor from immigrants that are coming to this country. And frankly, there just aren't enough visas to bring agricultural workers in the numbers we need them to Central Virginia. We also have tremendous technology and medical employers, hospitals throughout Central Virginia, throughout our district, and technology firms that are hiring many skilled workers from outside the United States. And so there's a need for individuals who want to bring their skill set to this country, be it in agriculture, be it in technology, be it in medicine. And I think we need to create a better pathway for them to get here legally, have the ability to invest in our communities. And one of the issues is that individuals who do come here on visas fully legally, because there's so much debate about immigration and the immigration process, is it impacts their ability to do things like buy a home or invest in a community, be part of the culture around them. And so it's not just an issue of someone's visa status. It's also an issue of what our communities look like when individuals don't feel that they have the long-term stability, that their visa may not be renewed, that they may not be able to stay in the job that they're doing. And so I think when we are talking about border security and immigration, so often we conflate these two issues. I worked border security issues. I used to work drug trafficking. So I'm acutely aware of some of the challenges that we face and how it is that drugs do cross the southern border, in particular at ports of entry. And that threat is something that we can address through greater technology, greater staffing along the border in terms of customs and border patrol agents. But to conflate that issue time and time again, issues of border security with our need for comprehensive immigration reform, I think doesn't do us any justice as we're trying to actually address these issues.
Speaking of agriculture and agricultural workers, you sit on the Agriculture Committee. Are you concerned that the Trump administration's policies of imposing tariffs on foreign goods, particularly from China and even on some of our allies, that is, their aluminum and steel products, do you think that these have adversely affected U.S. farmers and their products?
Yes, absolutely. And we've seen it in Central Virginia. We've seen long-term relationships. I've spoken with a farmer in Amelia County who has spent years and years developing strong relationships with buyers of his soybeans, and he's watched those relationships just go by the wayside because of tariffs. And secondary issue is we have rail lines that run through our district that carry soybeans from the farms out to the port. And when the tariffs went in place, there were ships that sailed back to China without picking up U.S. soybeans. And so it's not just the soybean farmers that are hurting, but it's also all of the other industries around it involved in that trade and commerce.
So speaking of then the trade war between U.S. and China, which is still in progress, even though negotiations are taking place to try to surmount that, if you were in charge, what do you think would be a better approach, perhaps, to combat China's unfair trading practices, its violations of intellectual property? Do you have a different approach than applying tariffs?
So I think tariffs can be a tool that should be used judiciously. I think that when we're looking at intellectual property and concerns that we have related to China stealing intellectual property, the correlation that has between intellectual property and soybean farmers is one that I fail to notice. And so I think that we in an effort to potentially react to China, have done so in this summary way that impacts soybean farmers, it impacts manufacturing, it impacts the consumer. We have a lot of development in our district, and prices of development, large schools, large buildings that rely on steel. Those are all of the impacts that we've seen across Central Virginia, and yet I haven't seen us any closer to dealing with the issue of China and intellectual property theft. So, you know, we had one problem and we broke something else as attempting to fix it. And I just don't see the correlation between what it is that we were attempting to do. It's just, it's hurting farmers and it's hurting industry.
As a centrist Democrat, you are probably very keen on working in a bipartisan fashion. I know you're a member of the Problem Solvers Caucus. Without actually abandoning your Democratic principles, do you see a window for legislation in the Congress? And if so, in what areas? And do you think that the Democratic Party, now in charge of the House of Representatives, is striking the right balance between necessary oversight of the executive and proposing and trying to pass legislation?
I'm a Democrat. I've always been a Democrat because I believe that the core values of the Democratic Party is that we can use legislation and policy to foundationally better people's lives, to create more opportunity, to create a more vibrant and rich country in a way that people can prosper. And we do that through policies that are fair and encourage growth and prioritize education and recognize that sometimes people need a boost if they've fallen on hard times. And so I somewhat reject these notions of always having to label where we fall on the spectrum because, you know, I think it is a moving target. And I think that if we want to create legislation that is long-lasting and impactful, we have to find places where we can agree. And I think a good example is the bipartisan background check bill that we just passed 2 weeks ago. And that bill, it was bipartisan. Republicans and Democrats came together, voted for it. And it is the largest piece and most impactful piece of gun violence prevention legislation that we've had in more than 20 years. I think on issues like prescription drugs and stabilizing Medicare, that's a great area where we can have bipartisan agreement because at the end of the day, you know, these are issues that impact everyone, regardless of your political ideology, infrastructure issues. We all benefit. We might disagree on how to go about prioritizing infrastructure issues, but when we have bridges and roads that work and broadband internet that connects our communities, that is going to positively impact, you know, the broad spectrum of Americans. And so I think discussing some of these issues where we can come together and then work our way towards an actual legislative next step, that's what I'm trying to do. That's where I'm trying to find some common ground. And I think it's necessary so that we get out of this volleying back and forth between Democrats are in charge and we do this and then Republicans are in charge and they undo it and then do something else and then flipping back and forth. It's not sustainable.
How about climate change? I know you serve on the Subcommittee on Energy and the Environment and you're interested in mitigating the effects of climate change. One of your colleagues, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and others are championing what is called the Green New Deal. It's sort of a blueprint for combating global warming. What is your reaction to that, and what specific proposals would you like to put forward in that regard?
It's great that my colleagues have raised the issue of global climate change. It's an economic issue, a healthcare issue, a national security issue, and it's an issue that concerns the overall health of our Earth. But with the proposals put forth, the non-binding resolution, it's a broad-reaching list of ideas and goals. And I'm looking for the next step where we start proposing policy that will actually help us achieve the goals that will put us on a better path towards mitigating climate change. There have been a lot of discussions related to how it is that we can reduce our carbon output, how we can mitigate the impact of global warming on the agricultural industry, how it is that we can use the agricultural industry and farmers to better our environmental practices in a way that is sustainable and also beneficial to our communities. So there's a lot of proposals that have been percolating, and I'm pleased that the conversation has sort of raised to the forefront, but I'm really focused on what policies we can actually take forward, how it is that we can prioritize renewable energy. Throughout Central Virginia, we've seen an increase in jobs in renewable energy, particularly with solar panel installation. I mean, it's these little steps forward that I think will make real impact when aggregated.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest is Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger. She's a newly elected Democrat from the state of Virginia. Congresswoman Spanberger serves on the House of Representatives Foreign Affairs and Agriculture Committees. I'm your host, Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a shout-out to loyal listener David Dauda from Mina, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Turning to foreign policy, we just talked about climate change before the break. And, of course, that's an area that obviously is a global issue because President Trump has withdrawn the United States from the Paris Climate Accord. And, again, on the international front, President Trump has promoted the so-called America First foreign policy, whereby he's implementing more protectionist economic policies, even abandoning agreements like the Paris Climate Accord, the Iran nuclear agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Are you in favor of this general direction, or do you have a different vision for America's role in the world?
So I'm not in favor of this general vision. I think that taking the United States out of the Paris Accords and the Iran nuclear deal, in every place where the United States has taken a stance where we are not recognizing the value of the long-term partnerships, I think is detrimental to our long-term national security. You know, the Iran nuclear deal isn't just an issue of trying to ensure that we don't have a nuclear Iran. It is also an example of a great multilateral agreement where multiple countries came to the table, and based on information and sharing and negotiation, we came up with a deal that was tenable for all of us. And so to just summarily walk away from that deal, I think is not only detrimental to the goal of having a non-nuclear Iran, it is also shakes those partner countries' faith in the United States. And so I have great concerns about that. The same is true for our decision to just summarily walk away from the Paris Accord. I think it signals the wrong thing to our partner countries throughout the world. And here in Congress, we actually passed a resolution that affirms the role of NATO and affirms our assessment that NATO is vital to U.S. foreign policy interests and our own national security. And so I hope that many of our partners throughout the world recognize that while there's a bit of an ebb and flow in U.S. foreign policy, that many of us in the legislative branch do recognize the long-term value of our historical and future relationships with other countries throughout the world.
Well, speaking of NATO, we're approaching the 70th anniversary of the NATO alliance. Do you think that the United States is doing enough to strengthen this transatlantic alliance, or are you concerned that Washington is alienating or even antagonizing our transatlantic allies?
I think that we are definitely not doing enough to recognize and assert the value of NATO. I think that some of the rhetoric that's come out of the executive branch has done just the opposite of that, has maybe shaken the foundation of trust that exists between the United States and our NATO allies. And I do think that members of Congress, particularly the Foreign Affairs Committee and all of Congress as a whole in passing this resolution, have taken steps to affirm our position that NATO is incredibly vital to our long-term national security and that the relationships under NATO are incredibly important to us. But I do have really significant concerns about a lot of the rhetoric coming out of the White House related to NATO.
And to what extent do you think this rhetoric and these actions, in a sense, play into one of our most formidable foreign adversaries' hands, and that is Russia's Vladimir Putin's hands, and therefore, in a sense, endanger our collective national security? As a follow-up, do you think we're doing enough to combat Vladimir Putin's Russia, which is an autocratic regime, which interfered in our elections, which interferes in many other elections around the world, particularly in Europe, to the detriment of mainstream center-left or center-right parties, and often bolsters far-right parties and populist parties?
It's troubling and unsurprising to see how harmful Russia's influence has been. We've seen Russia aggress against the United States in our 2016 elections. Moving into the future, we have to recognize, we being the international community, but particularly the United States, have to recognize the overall threat that Russia's propaganda or instability efforts have on this country and on our relationships across the world. I think that there's perhaps in recent years, never been a time where we've needed our NATO allies more, particularly given the aggressive nature, the aggressive posturing that Russia has made against the United States, and with allegations of meddling, be it in England, be it in France, be it in other elections. I think it's incredibly important that we affirm the relationships that we do have under NATO, that we engage in information sharing wherever possible to be sure that we can address these concerns. One of the things that the House passed last week, we passed H.R. 1, which is a campaign finance reform and good governance bill. But in that bill, there were multiple amendments meant to address foreign money flowing into our elections, the ability of foreign nations, foreign actors, foreign companies to purchase ads on social media, as we know Russian entities did in the 2016 and 2018 elections. I offered an amendment that would require the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, to provide threat assessments, be it from non-state actors, state actors, or just overall cyber weaknesses that may exist with our voting machines, to the individual states so the states can address any concerns and ideally safeguard and protect our elections. So there's a variety of things that we in Congress are trying to do to get at the threats that we see coming from Russia. Certainly there's investigations in the Intelligence Committee that's working to better understand what's happened and what continues to happen. But I think that all of it just points to the fact that it's incredibly important that we keep and affirm our strong relationships with our NATO allies.
In the few minutes we have left, I'd like to get your reaction on North Korea, the threat that it poses, and your reaction to President Trump's recent meeting in Hanoi. How do you see the Trump administration's approach to trying to combat this threat?
I think that the troubling step that they've taken is that they haven't fully acknowledged the real threat that exists, the fact that North Korea and Kim Jong-un do not function as rational actors. And I think going into bilateral top-level meetings without a real plan, without a real set of priorities, is a mistake. And I think that we need to be prioritizing working-level meetings with career diplomats who have previously gone to multiple diplomatic negotiation tables. They know when to walk away. They know when to push the envelope. And they're making efforts based on intelligence and diplomatic discussions. And so I think that's incredibly important. In terms of what happened in Hanoi, I'm pleased that we didn't walk away having given something up, which I think is what happened in Singapore, where we gave up on our military exercises with South Korea. And many military officials say that that impacts and harms our readiness. So the fact that we walked away without harming ourselves, I think, is helpful given what we've done in the past. But if we are going to come to the table again with North Korea, it has to be with a real plan, and it has to be with prioritizing the working level discussions and ideally allowing weeks, if not months, of those to carry on before the president engages again in the future.
Our hemisphere, Venezuela, the terrible tragedy that's going on, and the fact that the U.S. administration and many other countries around the world have now recognized Juan Guaido as the true leader. What is your view or your position with respect to the U.S. position on Venezuela and the stance that all options are on the table to actually force Maduro out of power, including a possible military intervention?
It's incredibly important that we support the Venezuelan people, that we affirm our desire to see any change in government leadership occur because the people are pushing for it. I support that the United States government has come out affirming their view that Guaido is the leader of the Venezuelan people. The notion that all options are on the table, inferring that we might take military action, I think is problematic because it is an aggressive stance towards the Venezuelan regime and not one that I think that we should be taking. I think that we should be working wherever possible to affirm our desire to see a peaceful transition of power, to support the efforts of the people on the ground.
Your colleague on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Ilhan Omar, freshman congresswoman from Minnesota, she's an outspoken critic of the policies of the government of Israel, especially toward Palestinians, but she recently made some controversial remarks that were construed as anti-Semitic, questioning the loyalty of American Jews who support the State of Israel. Do you think that Representative Omar has changed the discussion on U.S.-Israel relations among committee members? It's clear now that her committee assignment will not change, but how do you think she may have changed the discussion?
Truthfully, I don't think it's been changed in a very productive way. I think that it's the priority of all members of the committee to challenge our notions, to question where we give support, where we don't give support. And certainly with the current Israeli government, I think there's much to be critical of. There's much to question. And just frankly, as our partners and allies are questioning aspects of our government. But doing so, I think, in social media, doing so in a way that blurs the line between between questioning a government and challenging the actions of a government and making comments that many view as wholly anti-Semitic, I actually think it detracts from a real conversation that would be a beneficial one to have within the Foreign Affairs Committee.
One of my colleagues would like to know, who covers the elections, in terms of 2020, if you have a favorite among the Democratic candidates.
There are more. They're like sprouting up like daffodils. No, I don't have a favorite. I'm actually really trying to keep a measured look. It's very interesting, this first election, being an elected official myself, watching the array of who's coming forward. But I have my eye on a few people, and I've certainly liked the way the conversation's been really broadened by some of the new entrants. But not yet. I don't have a favorite.
Are you concerned about some of the intra-party tensions between the more liberal, younger members versus the establishment and some of the Democratic centrists like yourself, who are actually in the majority? It was the centrist Democrats who won the midterm elections. Do you think that the bigger impediment might be the Republican-controlled Senate, who could block legislative initiatives?
I think we have challenges on all fronts. I think we have opportunity on all fronts. And so when we look at the makeup of this Congress, 21 of our freshmen in the House are Democrats who flip seats in Trump districts. So when we look at how we got here in the majority, we got in the majority because 21 of us flipped seats in Trump districts, which was a feat, let me tell you, wasn't easy. And so long term, I want to keep the majority. I want to ensure that we can continue enacting good policies like campaign finance reform and gun violence prevention and prescription drug negotiations in the future. And so we're going to need to hold the majority. And I think some of the enthusiasm we see in our caucus is growing pains. It's figuring things out. I think it's great that we have a broad tent party. I think it's great that we have a diversity of ideas. And long term, I hope that we can get to a point where that excitement, enthusiasm, and positive agitation impacts the lives of everyday Americans in a really meaningful way when we pass good legislation. That does mean we meet the challenge of the Senate. And we have a Senate leader who is refusing to bring things to the floor that have passed in the House, such as our campaign finance reform bill. And that's incredibly disappointing, because if it goes to the floor of the Senate and it fails, so be it. That's the will of the people through their elected officials. But the notion that it would be refused to vote in the first place, I think, is a real challenge and a disservice to the American people.
And as we close, Congresswoman, we're running up to 2020 already. It seems like you just got elected.
Yes.
And you have a very small window to pass legislation. But in this run-up, many Republicans are accusing Democrats of pushing a so-called socialist agenda. This is becoming a sort of caricature in a way, but they're using this to try to scare perhaps many Americans. But it seems to me that the vast majority of Democrats, even those who self-describe as democratic socialists, pretty much accept the capitalist system, but they simply want it to be more equitable to benefit the middle class. Would you more or less agree with that? And how do you intend to combat these kinds of labels, which are erroneous?
I think as long as there's been a Democratic Party and a Republican Party, there's been labeling that's meant to try and flip control. And I imagine that calling Democrats socialists probably polls as a pretty productive attack on Democrats. But I think it's wholly erroneous. I think that it is detrimental, frankly, to the understanding that Americans have of what it is that we're working towards in Congress. And I think the impetus is on us to correct that misunderstanding, to say we're a capitalist country, we're a strong capitalist country, but we believe in guardrails. We believe in a Social Security program that ensures that our elderly aren't dying in poverty. We believe in having a Medicare and Medicaid program that makes sure that our most vulnerable Americans have the health care that they need. We believe in a public education system, because in our vibrant capitalist country, having a baseline education for everyone is something that spurs opportunity and creates greater economic prosperity, because we're leveling the playing field to some degree, but also creating greater opportunity for people to go out and open businesses and be entrepreneurs or join the workforce in whatever way. And so I think it is on us to fight back against these sort of simple labels. It's easy to label people in kind of these short targeted ways. And this seems to be an attack that I think we'll see from now until 2020 and maybe beyond. But it isn't representative of how it is that we're actually legislating and seeking to govern.
In another attack that you will have to combat probably is this label that somehow the Democrats are anti-Semitic or an anti-Israel party, which evidence shows is really quite the contrary.
It's a challenge, and this one I think is particularly corrosive in our communities, because the idea that one party would politicize hatred in a way to attempt to gain power, I think, is a gross debasement of our political system. And when we look back in Virginia, We had Charlottesville. We had people chanting Nazi slogans in the streets. We had violence in the streets. And it was driven by this type of hate, heavily anti-Semitic rhetoric, Nazi propaganda. And across central Virginia, we've had graffiti on the sides of Jewish community centers and synagogues. In Pennsylvania, had congregants murdered while at services. And this is a really strong threat to the fabric of our community and to the very lives of so many of our neighbors. Unless the next step is, and this is how we're combating it, to toss around that term for political gain, I just think is abhorrent.
Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger is a freshman Democrat from the state of Virginia. Congresswoman, thank you so much for your time and your wonderful insights on so many critical issues.
Thank you so much.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Mitch Biter and Patrice Martin for booking our guest. Our engineer and producer was Gary Jaffe. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.